C6, number 22B.
3 laws of logic, or 3 principles, whatever you may call it. And I give you these 3 principles, or these 3 laws, and I ask you to make a note of them so that later on, after 2 hours and 3 hours, you find these 3 principles at once in your note, so that we don't have to spend too much time, or you write them perhaps also on a separate paper and put it next to your notes, because we'll always refer back now to these 3 principles. The first law is the law of identity. The law of identity. When one is studying logic, one uses instead the terms for things, house, dogs, trees, people, and so on. One uses the alphabet, capitalized letters in the alphabet, to symbolize an identity. So what does this law of identity say? It says, a capital A, you know, A is identical to A. A is identical to A. Well, in blunt words for the child in kindergarten, you would say a dog is a dog. A dog is never a cat, and is never an elephant, and is never a tree. A dog is identical to itself. It's a dog. That's the law of identity, of the self-same identity, which says that a thing is a thing, and is always the thing that it is. And you think, well, that's so common sense that it is hardly worthwhile mentioning it. Well, that's why perhaps we are not aware of what classical logic is. So, a dog is a dog. And you think that is so. But transclassical logic will tell you that this is not so. That a dog is not a dog. And Christian Science will tell you that too. And that's the gist of it then. But I will take it slowly, just step by step. You have the second principle, the law of non-contradiction. The law of non-contradiction. You state it this way, you say, A is not, and then perhaps the capital, not hyphen A. A is not, not A. A is not, and then you capitalize not and the hyphen, A, huh? And not A, huh? Again, what you see is that something, an A, does not contradict itself by saying, I'm not A. So it's the law of non-contradiction. Mrs. Eddy uses that law very often. She says, for instance, if 2 statements directly contradict each other, and one is true, the other must be false. See, that's the law of non-contradiction. That 2 statements are opposite and one is true, then the other must be wrong. But, let's just go on to the third. The third is the law of the excluded middle. The law of the excluded middle. That's a terminus, a term, a technical term in logic. What does it mean? There are two variations. So the one, A, little a, is what? We state it like this. A can not be A, and at the same time not A. Perhaps you underline the end. That's the point in it. See what it means? That something cannot be something and at the same time not to be that something. Or the second version, little b, is A cannot be A, or not A. And perhaps you underline the or. So you have two statements that vary just a little bit. It's either and or in the second or. So that A cannot be what it is or something else. And you feel, yes, that's true. A chair cannot be a chair or an elephant, but because it has four legs. So you see, when you look over these three fundamental laws of classical logic, you feel, oh yes, that's so natural, because we have been trained in it right from the beginning as little children that this is so. But the trouble is that these are all wrong. That today we begin to see that this is not true. And therefore we'll see how this change came about. Therefore, can you see that it will overthrow our whole Western mentality? And the whole mentality which is absolutely ingrained in our consciousness. Now, let's take these three laws and let's just think how we would state them, for instance, in a statement in Christian Science, so as to have a better sense how this applies to the teaching of Christian Science. And we take just very easy statements so that they are easily recognizable. Let's take for the first law, the law of identity, a statement that we could make in Christian Science. See, that law of identity said what? You have it now on your notes. A is identical to A. Which would mean in Christian Science, for instance, that the A, we could take the A is God, Spirit, good, for instance. So that we would say God, good, Spirit is always God, Spirit. Good. That God, good Spirit, is always good Spirit. This is certainly something fundamental which we have all through the textbook, that God is good and therefore He is good, that He does not change and therefore is not at some times evil. So the law of identity is stated that God good is God good and not the opposite. Yeah? We take an example for the law of non-contradiction. Again, we take always the same rendering, God good Spirit cannot be And now it would show the not A. Therefore, what could we put there? Cannot be evil matter. That's the opposite of God, of good spirit. So God, good spirit, cannot be evil matter. Wouldn't you agree that this is something that runs right through the textbook constantly? That God, good, cannot be its very opposite. Yeah? See, logic is very easy at the beginning. We come to the third. Here we take verse 3a. What would we say there? We would say, God, good spirit. Cannot be good and evil, comma, spirit and matter. You hear that this logic goes right through Mrs. Eddy's textbook, isn't it? So you can see why we were feeling at the beginning that Mrs. Eddy was using classical logic. Or we take an example of 3b. God, good spirit. We start again the same way. God, good spirit. Cannot be good or evil. Spirit or matter. See, it has a slightly different touch. And again, this would go through the whole textbook. I mean, not just with spirit, it would go through it with mind, it would go through it with truth, it would go through life, you see. But life cannot be at the same time life and death. So, you would think that this is absolutely kindergarten stuff. And yet, think of this last statement and compare that, for instance, with the Bible that says, I make peace and create evil. Would that be classical logic? I, the Lord, to do all these things? Can you see that it would contradict really 3b? You see that the Bible is not written in the classical logic. The Bible was written long before the period of Aristotle, of the Greek period. Therefore, they did not know any logic. And we silly Western people come along with a classical logic and read the Bible with the classical logic. And then we throw it away and say, well, this is all nonsense. It all contradicts each other. It all is self-contradictory. So, boom. But naturally, they were writing, and that's the important thing to see, they were writing in the pre-classical time, therefore in the time where another kind of consciousness was the consciousness that the people had. They didn't have the classical logic, and so they were writing mostly in the mythical logic. And the mythical logic is a paradoxical logic. And you will see that there is a lot in that mythical logic if it is seen rightly. But what does it mean to see it rightly? That I will tell around about the last half hour today. So this is just showing the principles of classical logic, and I come to the third point. I call dualistic human thinking. Dualistic human thinking. That's point three. I have to talk a little bit about the history of consciousness, of human consciousness, because we are brought up in the Western world thinking the way we think is the only way to think, and that is the only right way to think, and that people have always been thinking the way we are thinking until then the cultural historians tell us that people in earlier ages were thinking quite differently, and they're also happy, or perhaps happier. Therefore, let's see where in the development of mankind human thinking, the way we know it, enters in. Well, we said this kind of logic is the classical period, and that's only 2,500 years ago. But before that period, people were thinking too. But they were thinking in a different way. Their way of thinking about the world was way back archaic sense of thinking. It was a kind of slumbering state, dreamy state of thinking, where everything was just somehow like a dream stuff, indefinite. But then, little by little, that thinking became more definite, and we entered the magic age, the age of magical thinking, where the word, each word, had power, and they began to discover the power of words, and where therefore much more thinking in terms that words have power. And so from there can come really the magical words, the magical verses, you know, the magical statements where with a definite term or a definite line of words, you could ban evil or you could bring about a phenomenon. Later on, the mankind entered into a mystical consciousness, and in that mystical consciousness they began already to see that the whole world was somehow woven together into one whole, where everything was interwoven with everything else. And you can see that in that mystical age they didn't have any sense of duality, because everything was interwoven into one thing. It really gave the first sense of oneness. And so we have to be careful that when people today speak about oneness, that we are aware that they can speak about oneness in a mystical way, and later on in a mystical way, but not in a scientific way. So terms don't matter. We should not be fooled by terms. In that mystical stage that just preceded really the classical age, that mystical stage, in which really the Bible, the Old Testament, has been written, is a stage where we had no sense of duality. No sense of duality. All that they already had was a sense of polarity or of complementarity, but not of duality. In that consciousness, they were thinking, as I said, in the oneness, but in an undifferentiated oneness. It's still that consciousness that is prevalent in the Eastern philosophies of trying to enter in the nirvana, which is the one and whole, but an undifferentiated whole. It's just an amorphous whole. So they had at the utmost a sense of polarity when they were speaking about heaven. They also knew that the other pole was earth, but they didn't think of it as dualistic. So they had a sense of complementarity. Yes, they were speaking about the husband, they were also thinking that is complementary to wife, husband-wife, which is not a duality, it's a complementarity. So the basic question really then came up, well, if there exists only one universe, and therefore not two universes, why then do we have suddenly the sense of dualism coming up? If the universe is one, why should we have dualism? And you can see that apparently dualism is not something that is innate in the universe itself. Insofar, the earlier consciousness, the magical consciousness and the mystical consciousness, was much nearer reality. But as a transitionary stage, the dualistic thinking made a terrific contribution to thinking. So if dualistic thinking is not innate in being, who made it? What made it? And therefore we must see, and this is important, that dualistic thinking is man-made. Is man-made. How did this come about? How did we create a dualistic thinking when initially there was no dualistic thinking? And this is, I think, the most interesting thing to see and to remember for us, how this dualistic thinking came into being, so to say. You see, with the scientific age, with the Greeks, they could see that dualism was the first step of ordering thinking. It wasn't therefore inventing something good and bad, but it was something very positive, namely that it was the first step of ordering, namely as you had the undifferentiated whole with no definite identities, therefore differentiation was the first step of ordering your universe for your human thinking. So it was just for the purpose of the human understanding that they began to differentiate between the phenomena, so as to create out of an undifferentiated whole a differentiated whole. We know really that chaos is just order that is not seen, not understood. In the one universe, there exists no chaos. Chaos, again, is only how we look at the ordered whole. And if we don't understand the differentiation, we think this one universe is chaotic. Therefore, chaos is order that is not seen. And therefore the question arises, how did one begin to see order? And so the very first differentiation that the Greeks made, you know, that Odysseus, we call him Odyssey, he was the first one, really, to see the first dualistic concept, namely, he differentiated for the first time, you wouldn't think that is so, as late as that, for the first time he differentiated between I and the universe. For the first time, somebody began to realize that he is something, an identity per se, that stands in opposition to the whole universe. So the first differentiation that is still fundamental in classical logic is the differentiation between I and not I. It's I as subject, and what is outside the I, the thinking I, is the object, the opposite, the object. And that's how dualistic thinking starts.